From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. It's Here and Now. The United States has passed a milestone that once seemed unimaginable. More than 800,000 people in the country have died from COVID-19. President Biden acknowledged the loss yesterday in a statement. It read, "To heal, we must remember, we must also act."
The president today is also visiting Kentucky, and that is where at least 74 people have died, and thousands are still without power or water after deadly tornadoes. For more, we're joined now by Asma Khalid, NPR White House correspondent. Asma, hello.
Hi there, Scott. It's good to be with you.
Good to talk to you. The president is consoler-in-chief today. What is he going to do in Kentucky?
So he's receiving a storm briefing. He's been keeping tabs on the situation from afar. You know, he's been in regular communication with the governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear. But today he'll be surveying the situation in person. He's visiting Mayfield and Dawson Springs. These are two of the hardest hit towns in the state, and the death toll there, you know, is still unclear. When he visits places to assess the devastation, he also often meets with people who are particularly affected by the situation. And, you know, we can expect some of that here today as well.
Over the years, Joe Biden has talked often about personal tragedy. He lost his son, Beau, in 2015. He lost his first wife and one-year-old daughter back in the early 70s. How do you think he might use those experiences to try to connect with people in Kentucky?
You know, Scott, as you mentioned, he does often refer back to those personal moments when he's discussing tragedy with other people. It's something that I saw him do often on the campaign trail, and it was something that I think really resonated with a lot of people. You would see folks lining up those rope lines to pour their own hearts out about their own personal stories with him. They feel like he is someone who often hears them. But at the same time, you know, there are moments where these personal stories about his own life don't resonate. You know, I think back to some of his remarks where he invoked his son, Beau, after 13 U.S. service members were killed in an attack at the Kabul airport in August. And there were some who thought, you know, frankly, at that moment, that that felt a bit tone deaf. So I don't want to hypothesize. I don't know how it will go over now, but it is something we often see him do in moments of tragedy.
As far as this disaster from Friday night and over the weekend, Joe Biden has made combating climate change a priority, but he has hesitated to connect the tornadoes directly to climate change. In a briefing Monday, here he is. Let's take a listen.
I've spent a lot of time on climate issues, and I said we have to be very careful. We can't say with absolute certainty that it was because of climate change.
So there's the science of climate change and these questions over what they call attribution. As far as the president, what sort of line is he trying to walk here?
Well, I will say it is a fine line. You know, in regard to those comments, while he said he wasn't willing to say that with certainty, he went on to say that what is certain is that it is one of the worst tornado disasters that we've seen in the country, and that it certainly was unusual in terms of how it happened, how many places it touched down, and the length of the path. You know, in this situation, both the president and his staff have been keen not to make the immediate issue about climate change just right at this moment. The deputy press secretary was actually asked again about this just as reporters were touching down in Kentucky this morning. And, you know, she said the focus right now is really on the response in Kentucky, just making sure the folks there get the resources that they need.
Kentucky, as we know, it is a red state in general. It went for Donald Trump in 2020 by a wide margin. Just how unusual is this for President Biden to visit a red state?
You know, I will say, and I don't know if we can say it's a pattern yet, but we've seen him certainly do this when it comes to other natural disasters in other parts of the country. I was with him on a trip to Idaho where he went to deal with forest fires out west. He made a trip also to Louisiana. You know, I will say that he made these remarks just the other day as well, that he wants folks to know, he feels, that in moments like this, that we are, as a country, Democrats and Republicans. He has emphasized that we are all Americans, and that he's been rather nostalgic about wanting folks to realize that there is this common unity, particularly in moments of tragedy. And so I will say we see him visiting red states as they have been hit by natural disasters.
Now, Joe Biden is asking the people of Kentucky to have faith in him. But the poll numbers suggest that a lot of Americans might be losing their faith in Joe Biden. The numbers are slipping. What is at stake for him in this moment?
You know, that's a really tough question, Scott. I mean, I will say that you're right. The poll numbers have been slipping, and I think there's a number of factors at play here. You know, part of this is quite candidly that the pandemic has been dragging on now for months, and people don't really see a clear end, despite vaccination rates, despite even more people getting boosterized at this point. The other real big challenge for the president is that at the same time, there are rising prices and inflation, and that this has been a concern, I will say, that a lot of people have been very deeply affected by as they look at their grocery bills and their gas bills.
NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Washington National Cathedral will toll its morning bell 800 times today to honor the lives of the 800,000 people who've died from the pandemic. Health officials say a wave of new infections from the Omicron variant could spike in January, and that could overwhelm hospitals already pushed to the brink. In November, 7% of the 3,000 residents of Petersburg, Alaska, were infected with COVID. In response, a team of home health nurses went door to door to treat patients in the remote island town. Angela Denning of KFSK in Petersburg reports.
This is our COVID section right here.
Nurse Kirsten Testoni is sorting through medical equipment inside Petersburg Medical Center's home health supply room. Metal shelves stacked with PPE and plastic tubs of bandages, scissors, and needles take up one of the walls.
Hey, Yvonne. Yeah. Do you have any more of those batteries? We're like out of pulse oxes.
Yes, ma'am.
Pulse ox is short for pulse oximeter, those little clamps that go on your finger and measure your blood oxygen levels. They're in high demand in Petersburg.
You come in with sort of a plan, but your day goes from 0 to 60.
Testoni manages a team of 8. Before the pandemic, there were only 2 home care nurses in this office. The additional staff has come from other departments, ERs, clinics, long-term care. Lena Odegaard has worked in all of them. She says she likes home health because she can focus on one patient at a time, but it's also challenging.
There's just so many elements you can't control, whereas when you're in the facility, you can kind of restrict visitors and what people are doing to a point.
Sometimes there are patients who should go to the hospital, but they don't want to.
We find that quite often in home health, especially during this pandemic. Sometimes there's a little bit of a resistance.
Many times the nurses will transport patients to the hospital themselves, or they call an ambulance. Stephanie Romine says home health is different than her many years working in the local hospital.
You can walk in and find someone on the floor, or, you know, you really don't know what you're walking into a lot of times.
Many hospitals have home health departments, but it's different in a rural town like Petersburg, says Jared Kosin. He heads the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
You're going to have almost, in some respects, a more nimble healthcare system because everybody knows everyone. And when we're in a crisis like this, can we meet this problem head on before it becomes a bigger problem and requires hospitalization?
During the latest Delta surge in Alaska, it's been crucial to keep people out of the hospital, not just Petersburg's local clinics, but also keeping the sick from getting medevaced to the bigger hospitals in Anchorage. Plus, it's a more personal way to receive care. The program is paid for through insurance reimbursements and hospital subsidies. And it's been so successful that the Petersburg Hospital is planning on keeping this level of home health care, even when they're no longer caring for COVID patients. On this day, Testoni is in her car, gearing up to visit a small house where 3 people are infected with COVID. She puts on 2 face masks, goggles, a hairnet, a gown, and blue rubber gloves.
All right. You ready?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Natasha Lyons answers the door. She's 43. She's in a black sweatshirt, her blonde hair pulled back.
Sorry, my house is not being weak. I don't have any energy.
In the last week, she's been to the ER twice.
I was so bad and so weak, I couldn't even get up to go pee at one point. I had to have help from my son.
A member of the home health team drove her back and forth to the hospital. She received oxygen, IV fluids, monoclonal antibody treatment, and steroids.
If it wasn't for the home health people, I wouldn't have made it because I was too weak to drive myself. I was too weak to even walk. I was too weak to do anything. It's been very scary for me.
Testoni checks Lyon's oxygen levels.
Oh, it was 98. That's Ooh. The best it's been since forever. The lowest I think was 84.
That's pretty low.
Like many Petersburg residents this team has been caring for recently, Lyons isn't vaccinated. And she hasn't changed her mind, even after two trips to the ER. But Testoni never pushes the issue.
You know, that's not our role. We don't do that. I mean, we are going to take care of people regardless of what their choices are.
Walking back to the car, Testoni says her job isn't to convince patients of anything. It's to meet them where they are. And so far, that's been enough to help keep them alive. For Here and Now, I'm Angela Denning.
When people want to forecast for the weather, they turn to the National Weather Service. What about forecasting disease? There are a lot of models and data out there, but they're confusing and often don't talk to one another. So the CDC wants to create better models and aggregate the ones we have now with a new $200 million Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics. Dr. Mark Lipsitch is science director there, and he joins us. And Dr. Lipsitch, as we try to process the news that 800,000 Americans have passed from COVID-19, how will your center hope to use data to try to get ahead of future waves?
Well, that is the great question. And we have been trying to set up the center as the pandemic looked like it might be winding down. And now as we see Omicron coming, we've begun to try to be useful in the present. What we want to do in the long run on a smaller scale now is to take the vast amount of data that we have to add to that by designing ways to improve the flow and quality of data, and then to use what are known as transmission dynamic models and forecasting tools to understand what may lie ahead and to help decision makers target interventions so that they are as effective as possible while minimizing the disruption that they cause.
And what are some of the key data tools that you and your colleagues will be using? Will it be hospital data or data on where people are traveling, fitness trackers? What are the key sources of data that you're going to put together?
I think one thing we've learned from SARS-1 in 2003 and then pandemic flu in 2009 and SARS-2 now is that the kinds of data you need in each outbreak are not the same. So the first thing is to have a diversity of data sources. And particularly in the United States, where we don't have a centralized healthcare system, that diversity of data sources is really essential. So hospitalizations are almost always important. Non-traditional sources of data, such as mobility or prescriptions or even non-prescription drug sales, all of those things have a role. But as we've seen in this pandemic, there is also the importance of case counting. But I think one of the things that is less obvious from the outside, but has become really clear during this pandemic, is that smaller amounts of data from very well-studied populations are more valuable in some ways than larger amounts of data that you don't know as much about the people. Other countries such as Israel and the United Kingdom that have more centralized healthcare systems, their whole population in a way fits that description.
Mm-hmm. As I was reading up on this, I came across what I guess is an old saying in your field: if you've seen one pandemic, you've seen one pandemic. So how can you be, I guess, dynamic, knowing that historic data patterns can only tell you so much?
That is the role of a well-trained public health workforce. One of the things, if you look inside the response at CDC, the whole agency is mobilized for COVID. They come from foodborne disease background. They come from an injury background. They come from a school health background. They come from non-communicable disease backgrounds, just to name a few. And each of those have experience that's relevant to understanding the spider-like impact of this pandemic. It has legs in all parts of our lives, unfortunately. Uh-huh. But we also have to have systems that can tell us as quickly as possible what are the characteristics of the new agent that we're facing.
One of the biggest challenges that I understand modelers face is one that no amount of science control, and that is human behavior. People might travel, they might decide to wear masks or no, they might get their vaccines, they might forego them. That's a giant variable here.
That is. It's important to be clear that that is the fundamental limit to forecasting in the narrow sense of saying, I believe with 80% probability that there will be this range of number of cases in the next week, because anything that depends on future transmissions is dependent on human behavior that we can't be certain about. That is why forecasts, in the sense that we do weather forecasting, have an inherent limit to how long they can go. What we need to be better at is investing in improving the science so that it can get to the limits of what we can do based on what we do know about behavior, and also incorporate the possibilities of behavior change and even anticipating how that might happen in response to spread. That's the limitation. It's also why we have another kind of activity that we think of as part of forecasting, what we call scenarios. And the distinction is a scenario is an if-then statement, but as is the case right now with Omicron, we don't really know how severe the cases are going to be. And so the scenarios incorporate much more uncertainty. And it's an if-then in the sense of if the severity turns out to be this, which we think is plausible, then.
Finally, I guess this leads me to ask about timing. There have been comparisons drawn to weather forecasting, and we know with computers and modeling and data in that space, it has taken years, decades to get to where that field is now. What does the timeline look like here? I mean, if there is this wave or a next wave coming, say, in 2022, is that a reasonable timeline where your center might be able to say, we have found important signals that we can tell the public about?
Yeah, it's not all or nothing. I mean, weather forecasting in the past was not great. Now it's much better. In the same way, the transition from unreliable to reliable has been based on investment and improvements of the science and of the computation. In some ways, we are at a better place because we have better computational skills. On the other hand, the science of predicting epidemics is even harder than weather forecasting for the reasons we've talked about with behavior and uncertainty and the fact that we can't measure it as easily. We have a lot to do, but the thing to do is to start generating predictions now and make it better and better so that we can be of greater use. And many health departments around the country now and around the world have been using forecasting tools to make better decisions. It's just we are trying to supercharge that by putting it on a scale that's suitable for a world-class system.
Dr. Mark Lipsitch is Science Director at the CDC's new Center for Forecast and Outbreak Analytics. Dr. Lipsitch, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Today, there's another tragic marker of the pandemic's toll in the U.S. More than 800,000 people have now died from COVID-19. It was hard to even fathom that number when the outbreak began early last year. For each of those lost, there are loved ones, family members, and friends left behind. Earlier this year, NPR remembered some of those who lost their lives. We've called these tributes Songs of Remembrance. They draw on music those lost loved. Today, we revisit one of those tributes. Julie Seda of Chatsford, Pennsylvania, remembers her former housekeeper and family friend, Janet Gonzalez. Gonzalez died in Puerto Rico last year on New Year's Eve.
Janet was from Santurce, Puerto Rico, and she was a natural caretaker and a very wise person. She was so fun to be around, and she made the best tostones, the best rice and beans, and she made it all seem very easy. My best memory of her was when we invited my mother to lunch, and she cooked for both of my parents, and she wanted to treat them like they were royalty. She was so incredibly warm to them just because they were my parents, and she didn't have a reason to be like that. You know, she could have just helped in whatever way she could and go home. But no, she wanted everybody to feel warm around her and feel well-fed and feel special around her. Also, I remember how she would talk about celebrities like she knew them personally. One of our biggest subjects was Mark Anthony and Jennifer Lopez. And we spent hours sometimes just chatting about how she was sure that they were a couple for a long time. And that always strikes me because you know how you have this kind of a friendship that never ends. And you can talk to a person one day and talk to her years later and just strike conversations back. So with Janet, our conversations would turn back into funny things like that. But we just had fun about it. It was just a natural friendship. Janet loved Adios Le Pido by Juanes because it's a song that represents who she is, somebody who would trust God. So she'd be working around the house and she was, Adios Le Pido, mi reina. Adios Le Pido. Que te quedes a mi lado y que más nunca te me vayas, mi vida. Adios Le Pido. Que mi alma no descanse cuando de amarte se trate, mi cielo. Adios Le Pido. In that song, you ask God and he hears you. And that was one of her biggest pieces of advice she always gave me. Don't question God and he will hear you. She just had this ability to connect with people. With her cheerful kind of person who would just mumble a song left and right every day as she constantly going into people's houses and doing work they don't want to do. So as we stroke a friendship, it started as just like, help me out with this, but I became part of her family. She chose me as part of her family. That's how I got to know her spirit, and that's how I got to know this amazing person. And I want to pay homage to how much she cared for us and for her children, Janita and Jan, to be proud of that. The fact that their mother touched many, many lives in her life in a very positive way. Adios le pido.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Many travelers who have returned to the skies are finding them less than friendly. They've had flights canceled because a lot of airlines are understaffed. And this even though the industry got $54 billion taxpayer dollars to support payroll during this pandemic. And today the CEOs of United, American, Southwest, and the COO of Delta appear before a Senate committee wanting some answers. So let's get some of our own from Seth Kaplan, our transportation analyst. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Scott.
So the airlines got this money, which is called the Payroll Support Program, and now we're learning that they don't have enough staff to keep flights going every day. Where'd the money go?
Well, the money did mostly go to pay workers. Airlines would say it all went to pay workers, and they were required to not involuntarily furlough employees. But what they were very much allowed to do and what they did was incentivize workers to retire early. And so you had tens of thousands of workers say, yeah, I'll take that extra year of pay, those guaranteed health benefits, maybe flight benefits, especially people who were on the verge of maybe retiring anyway before long. And so airlines quickly found themselves going from having too many workers back when nobody wanted to fly to having, yeah, not enough workers in some cases to meet the new travel demand as the pandemic at least has begun to ease and people begin to travel again.
Now, in his prepared testimony ahead of this afternoon's hearing, American CEO Doug Parker plans to say the program saved the airline industry, and Southwest head Gary Kelly's statement simply says it worked, all caps. How do you think senators are going to counter that?
Well, a lot of them are upset that airlines continue, for example, to do some of the things that consumers don't like charge fees. Some congressmen have said, you know, in excess of what they need. You know, when you pay $35 to check a bag, it doesn't really cost $35 necessarily to transport that bag. Airlines just see that as the way they've reformed their business to a point where they are sustainable. Now, look, whether or not it saved the industry, it clearly saved jobs. That was the difference. After 9/11, there was a rescue plan, but it was basically the opposite. Basically, the government worked almost like a venture capital firm, say, hey, we'll give you some money, but you have to get rid of people. You have to shrink. This time they said, we'll give you the money, but you have to keep people. So what it indisputably did was save a lot of jobs. Whether or not the airlines could have managed, but just in more painful ways for their workers, this time is a separate question.
In general now, what is the financial picture for the airlines?
Well, they're getting back on their feet. All of these airlines survived. In the U.S., you didn't have any major airline bankruptcies. Even around the world, you had some of that more painful restructuring. But one thing that's clear, you mentioned Doug Parker from American Airlines. He predicted several years ago that airlines had reformed themselves to the point that they would never again lose money, a big airline like American. And that was proven wrong. An industry that still, as we saw during the pandemic, was vulnerable to a shock like the pandemic.
Yeah. And quickly on Doug Parker, he's departing as CEO. What shape is he leaving American in?
American is a perfectly sustainable airline right now that's gotten back on its feet. A less profitable one, though, than Delta. And now also than United, which is run by a former Lieutenant Scott Kirby of Doug Parker. United's gotten itself very much back on its feet as well.
Seth Kaplan is Here and Now transportation analyst. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
It's an age-old question for educators. How do you get students to learn better? Our next guest has one answer: get them to listen better. Monica Brady Myroff is a former public radio reporter. She left journalism to start ListenWise. It's a company that uses curated radio and podcast pieces to build better listeners in K through 12 classrooms. She writes about this in her book, ListenWise. Welcome, Monica.
Hi, Lisa.
We should say right at the top that you're a former reporter for our home station, WBUR. We know each other well. And as a reporter, you first became interested in audio storytelling. But I know that your view of the power of audio has expanded greatly with the help, in part, of your daughter. And I wonder if you can tell us that story.
Yeah, well, I was working as a reporter at WBUR, and my daughter was in about the third grade learning to read, and she was really struggling. And I got called in to her teacher to talk about what problem she was having and how we could help. But one thing I noticed was that because we listened every morning to NPR on the radio station, she understood everything that she heard. And I knew that if I had put a script in front of her and asked her to read it and have a conversation about the news, she never could have done that. So it just struck me that she is like many children out there who have trouble reading but can understand what they hear much at a much higher level. So that really launched me on this idea of taking all the great audio stories that are happening on public radio and in podcasts and getting them into the hands of teachers so that students like my daughter can succeed through listening.
So you started this company, ListenWise, that uses audio excerpts from, as you said, public radio stories and from podcasts, and you play them for children, or you give instruction on playing them for children. The stories that you pick, what are you looking for in particular, stories that you think would encourage listening?
Well, we're looking for stories that are aligned to what teachers need to teach, first of all, because we want them to use them in the classroom, but just as important as stories that really captivate you, that in just a few short seconds you can transport students somewhere else, either by building empathy with a character, with a person they're listening to, but also just describing other parts of the world and sensory. I mean, listening is such a sensory mode of learning, and we don't always think about it that way because it's sort of a passive thing that we all do. But in reality, we are activating so many parts of our brain when we listen. And I'd love to illustrate something along those lines if we can play a short clip from an NPR story by science reporter Michaeline Dukleff. And as you listen, I want you to think about what you are seeing, what you're feeling, what you're smelling while you're listening.
We've got bug spray. We've got headlamps. We're going into the forest. And it's deep.
And it's steep.
That's Kevin Olival.
Okay.
He's a virus hunter with EcoHealth Alliance, a U.S.-based group of scientists. They fly around the world looking for killer viruses.
Becomes dense right away.
Ooh, thorns.
He's brought me to a tropical rainforest. We're on the island of Borneo in Malaysia.
This way.
Because this is the type of place where outbreaks are born.
So that clip, I'm curious to hear from you, Lisa. What did that forest look like for you? What did it feel like?
Well, I'd say that it felt like it was buggy. It felt like it was kind of humid and oppressive. And that was in part from the ambience, what we call the ambience, which is the sound behind the story. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I'm getting at the fact that listening is an immersed experience view. That is what neuroscientists call it. Our brains are simulating what it's actually like to be in a scene, especially one as sound-rich as the one we just listened to. But imagine if you can take students there really quickly and then illustrate a point about science that you're learning in a classroom. That's what makes listening so powerful in learning.
But does what a student or child is listening to have to have that kind of rich ambience? If it's just a good story, are they going to listen to it then, even if it's sort of bare bones?
Oh, yeah, especially if it's well told. There are studies that show that just telling a good story improves your ability to listen. And the fact is that, like, we don't get better at listening as we get older. We just do that by really practicing listening as a skill. Mm-hmm. And too many of our educators really have a professional blind spot when it comes to listening. They don't think that it needs to be taught. They focus more on the traditional skills, math and reading, and that's understandable. But listening really is an essential skill that all effective learners need to know and improve.
You know, it's interesting because you say that teachers don't necessarily teach listening, but they sure get angry when kids don't listen, which happens a lot.
Yes, that is so true. I hear that all the time when I say, I've written a book called Listen Wise. Teach your students to be better listeners. They say, how? How can I do that? I said, well, you've got to help them exercise their listening muscle.
So I have a question about that, though. Yeah, there is a muscle, but it feels like there is so much working in the opposite direction, you know, in terms of torque. It's like whenever you, for instance, go online, as kids are wont to do, everything is trying to take you in a different direction within a nanosecond of your getting onto it. So, you know, we have short attention spans that are getting shorter all the time, and that includes children. So how on earth do you fight against that by trying to get kids to sort of just sit still and listen?
It's practice. It's really giving the teachers the tools to talk with their students about all the different types of listening that they're doing every day without realizing it. Precise listening, descriptive listening, strategic listening, and really helping them realize that they are in control of this listening muscle. And if they use it well, they're going to have a much easier time remembering the content or being engaged with their friends or not getting yelled at by their teachers or parents for not listening.
There are problems that some people have with the written word. They might have a problem with dyslexia, for instance. And there are inherent problems that people have with listening. How do you work with those?
Well, in terms of the reading challenges, students can listen at 2 to 3 grade levels higher than they can read. And listening is used regularly in the types of remediation for students who are struggling readers. But then there are also, I'm sure, students who struggle with listening. So on our platform and in many of the activities, there are many other supports such as pictures and other things to read that go along with the audio. We have transcripts with every single piece of audio. And that's a research-based, proven approach to improving literacy. Listening and reading at the same time really improves reading.
And you say in the book that if you are a good reader, you're going to be a good listener and vice versa.
Well, right now we know if you're a good listener, you're going to be a better reader. And that's because listening is an essential part of learning to read. It's a combination of decoding and language comprehension. And in our classrooms today, we have many, many ways to measure the reader as they progress up the scale of proficiency. But we don't have a way to measure the listener, even though these are so tightly tied.
Monica, can you talk about the changes that you have seen as a result of students having better developed listening skills?
Oh, I've heard some great stories from teachers. They say their students are more attuned to the world, that they're really absorbing material through listening, that then they will recount details of 2 weeks later, that there's a level of retention that's impressive, and that it's been a great way for students to get background knowledge about maybe a book that they're about to read. And they listen to an interview with Lois Lowry about why she wrote The Giver, let's say, and that really tunes them in and gets them excited to read.
You're speaking to a lot of parents in the audience. If they want to do one thing tonight with their child to get them to learn to listen, what would you recommend?
Well, I'd recommend what we do around our dining room table, which is just start by listening to your kids intentionally and giving them the space to talk and be heard. So we have a tradition in our family where we just ask a few simple questions. How was your day? Tell me one good thing. Tell me one bad thing that happened. Then we always ask them, and what did you do that was nice for someone else? And it gives them the power to speak as well as listen and share a little bit of themselves. And that's really what listening is all about.
So you're teaching them how to listen by you're doing the listening yourself.
Yeah, we are showing them. That is the number one thing. And when teachers ask me, I don't know how to get my students to listen, I say, well, have you taught them how to listen by showing them that you're listening and how you listen? Talk about what good listening is. Requires of you, that you have eye contact and you're nodding and you're not looking at your phone and you're parroting back what they say. Maybe you're asking a follow-up question. All of these things happen at our dinner table too. And that is what has built, I think, a strength of listening among our daughters. And I think it's easy for anyone to do too.
Monica Brady Myroff's book is called Listen Wise: Teach Students to Be Better Listeners. Monica, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening.
Alec Burks guarding him from the start. Wiggins again. Here's Curry for the record. It's good! There it is! Stephen Curry!
That's Steph Curry leaping into history during last night's game at Madison Square Garden against the New York Knicks. The Golden State Warriors point guard hit his 2,974th three-pointer. That breaks the record set by former NBA player Ray Allen. But coping with COVID-19 is still an issue for sports. The NBA and other major sports leagues are postponing, moving, or canceling games. To help us better understand what this means for sports as we head into the colder winter months, here is Sports Illustrated senior writer Stephanie Apstein. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me.
So that was a pretty incredible night for Steph Curry, but I want to talk about the larger issue that is facing sports and the NBA in particular. The outbreak has caused the NBA to postpone the Chicago Bulls' next two games. What does this mean for the league as it is in midseason now?
It's a problem. The safest way to proceed once an outbreak starts is to start canceling games, but that becomes an issue for scheduling.
An issue for scheduling that could have what knock-on effects?
Fortunately, there's enough time left in the season that they can sort of get this under control. But in leagues like the NFL, where they're already at the end of the season, it's a real problem for who makes the playoffs, who doesn't. You know, every game matters, especially as you get closer to the end.
And when we look at the teams themselves, nearly half the teams say that their players are already fully vaccinated or on the cusp of hitting that threshold. Can you talk a little bit more about testing protocols and other measures that are in place for not just the players, but trainers and staff too?
Yeah, I think that's part of what's so alarming for the leagues right now. 97% of NBA players are fully vaccinated, something like 60% are boosted, but they are still testing positive. So the protocols for basically every league at this point are that unvaccinated players are tested daily and vaccinated players are tested a little bit less frequently. And usually it's a little bit easier for a vaccinated player to return to play after testing positive. So they only have to return, say, two negative tests with 24 hours apart rather than an unvaccinated player who has to wait.
Let's talk about hockey for a minute. The NHL said on Monday it is postponing the Calgary Flames games through at least tomorrow because of COVID. And this comes after the league said that more than 99% of players are vaccinated in the NHL against the virus. But some players continue to test positive. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's actually all but four NHL players. So that's a really impressive vaccination rate. But again, they've had to postpone games. It's especially challenging there because there's so much travel through Canada. So people have to be really careful about, you know, quarantine laws when crossing the border. The problem is that a lot of these sports are sort of breeding grounds for COVID, right? They're indoors, they're breathing in each other's faces, they're breathing hard, and then they gather in crowded locker rooms. It's a lot of, you know, you're asking a lot of the vaccine and of your immune system. And again, fortunately, there haven't been any serious cases, but they're starting to see, again, that this is really the only way to stop it is to cancel games, and then that leaves you with problems.
So how about the NFL, which has actually gone through the season without canceling a game? How did that happen?
The NFL has a couple of inherent advantages. The games are largely outside. They have huge rosters, so even if they lose a couple of guys, they can usually play on. And then the games being only weekly is very helpful. They haven't really had to do it this year, but last year, for example, they would push a game back a day or two. But it's starting to be really, really problematic there as well. Like half of the Cleveland Browns offensive players have tested positive in the last couple of days, including the quarterback and the head coach. The plan at the moment is for them to play, but their game is Saturday. I mean, they have to, those guys have to return two tests 24 hours apart. That's going to be hard to get. And as we get close to the end of the season, something like this could end up deciding a champion.
Right. And tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, we're 2 months away from the Super Bowl. How much of an impact could COVID have on the game and who's playing in it?
It's huge, especially in the NFL where, you know, they only play 16 games in the season, or they play 17 now. You don't have a lot of room to make up for a game that you lost because, say, your quarterback had tested positive. Mm-hmm. So if indeed Baker Mayfield, the Browns quarterback, can't play this weekend, that would be a huge problem for a team that really needs him.
What would you say overall, Stephanie, the impact of COVID this year has been on the teams that we've been talking about and others as well, the leagues we've been talking about as well? We know that it's expensive because it's hard to keep NBA players in a bubble, as happened last season, not this season. The testing protocol is pretty expensive as well, of course. What's the overall impact this time around?
I think it's high, and I think it's higher than people sort of expected as the season opened. I think we all thought, okay, if we just get these guys vaccinated, it'll be okay. But I think the logistical challenge has been greater than anyone expected. And so the leagues are starting to talk about tightening protocols again, starting to treat all players like they're unvaccinated, forcing them to wear masks indoors, even if they're vaccinated. The NFL is going to have to start talking about whether to put their playoff teams in a bubble, even though, as you said, it's incredibly expensive and a lot of players will not appreciate being asked to live away from their families for that long. This is something that they're sort of still trying to figure out how to live with.
All right. Stephanie Epstein, senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.